Excellent. Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Board of Osteopathic Medical Examiners. I'd like to take just a moment before we start to review our mission. The mission of the board is to protect the public by setting educational and training standards for licensure and by reviewing complaints made against osteopathic physicians, interns, and residents to ensure that their conduct meets the standards of the profession as defined by law, ARS 32-1854. We do like to call the meeting to order and continue on to roll call, Mr. Bohol.
Yes. Okay. Time is 9:06 a.m. The meeting is being held virtually, and I will call the roll. Dr. Rosenberg is absent. Dr. Cunningham.
Here.
Ms. Bichelle is absent. Dr. Walker is absent. Mr. Goodman.
Aye.
Thank you. Dr. Chabon.
Present.
And Dr. Maynham.
Present.
You have a quorum of board members, sir.
Thank you very much. I'd like to move on to item number 3 on the agenda. Welcome to the medical students, Midwestern University, Arizona College of Osteopathic Medicine, and A.T. Still University School of Osteopathic Medicine in Arizona. Do we have students logged on, Mr. Bohol?
Yes, we should have about 20 students today.
Oh, good. I'm glad I wasn't talking to nobody. I do that sometimes. Do we have anybody signed in as a call to the public?
We have no one signed in to speak.
Oh, perfect. Okay. We can move on to item number 4, reviewing consideration approval of the minutes. I can take May 22, 2026 open session and executive session together. We have... Three board members that were present during that. Is that correct, Mr. Bohol?
Yes.
I'm going to have to recuse myself, Dr. Cunningham.
Right. So, Mr. Bohol, I don't think I actually have a quorum to vote on that particular meeting. Is that correct?
Because, Mr. Goodman, you were not at that. You were at that meeting.
Mr. Goodman was. Dr. Cunningham was the only one who was detained.
You can, following the rule of the quorum of board members present, you can complete that vote.
Very good. Is there any discussion on amendments for the motion? Otherwise, for the minutes for open and executive session, otherwise I'll take a motion.
I move to approve both sets of minutes.
Thank you.
I'll second.
Thank you very much. If no further discussion, all in favor, please indicate with an aye.
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 Thank you very much. We can conclude that then, Mr. Bohol. Would it be best to move on to item number 5 next?
That is correct.
Please go ahead.
Okay. Item 5A is case number DO-2401-90A, in the case of Andrew Smith, DO. I believe Dr. Smith has signed in to speak.
And Justin, Dr. Maynham, I'm going to recuse myself from this item.
Very good. Thank you very much. Are you going to move into a different room, Mr. Bohol?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman.
We can resume.
Perfect. I believe you're presenting this one, Mr. Bohol.
Yes. I'll pull up the OMC report here. this case was reviewed by a board-certified orthopedic surgeon. This case involved patient SK, a 67-year-old female, first seen by Dr. Smith in early May 2000 for complaints related to right knee and left shoulder. On May 28th, 2020, Dr. Smith performed a right knee arthroscopic partial medial and lateral meniscectomy She was seen periodically for post-op visits related to her right knee surgery in June of 2020. At each visit, the medical records note essentially copy and paste versions of her left shoulder complaints from the initial visit. There was no change in the potential diagnosis or plan for the left shoulder throughout that time. It appears that every medical record during that period shows identical complaints, physical exam, and plan related to the left shoulder. However, on July 2nd, 2020, Dr. Smith dictated, "For her left shoulder, I reviewed her MRI and physical exam findings with her. We discussed non-surgical and surgical treatment options. Based on her MRI, I recommended that she undergo a left atomic total shoulder arthroplasty. To that date, no plane x-rays had ever been documented in the records. There is no discussion of medical records concerning the sudden shift in the treatment plan, and the indications of total shoulder arthroplasty were not documented. Conservative management of the arthritic shoulder was never documented. No shoulder diagnosis as a potential source of her complaints was entertained. Plain x-rays as a mean to grade the severity of her arthritis was never performed." In August of 2020, she underwent medical clearance for an upcoming left total shoulder arthroplasty. On September 3rd, the patient was taken to the operating room by Dr. Smith for a left total shoulder arthroplasty. Surgery was performed under general anesthesia. Surgery was performed on a standard operating table in the supine position. Head was secured in a head holder, and the bed was positioned in a semi-beach chair position. The left upper extremity was placed in a spider arm holder. Patient was admitted overnight for pain relief and observation. Post-op x-rays in the recovery room noted a left total shoulder arthroplasty in place with no obvious signs of malposition or complications such as fracture, etc. Vascular checks, including skin color and pulses, were recorded as normal the night after the surgery as well as the morning after surgery. The physical therapist noted the morning after surgery that her sensation was diminished, which was felt to be due to the effects of a nerve block. The patient's arm was immobilized in a sling, and therefore a motor exam was not fully assessed. It is unclear from the medical records the status of her neurovascular exam in the left hand postoperatively. The patient was discharged home the morning after surgery on September 4th, 2020. Patient presented at Northwest Medical Center emergency room on September 5th, 2020, complaining of accelerating severe left arm pain. Patient never regained sensation in her left arm extremity and was now complaining of a burning and tingling down her left arm. The appearance of her left arm was now mottled, and there was no palpable pulses or pulses by Doppler in the left upper extremity. The emergency room staff was appropriately concerned that the patient had a severe arterial defect from the left upper extremity. Vascular surgery consult was summoned. Patient was taken to the operating room on September 5th. Sorry, lost place in my notes.
That's okay. Take your time. Rather do it right for Dr. Smith here.
When the vascular portion of the case was complete, Dr. Smith resumed further orthopedic intervention. Patient was taken back to the operating room September 7th, 2020 for wound check and dressing change. Patient returned to the operating room September 12th, 2020 for repeat wound check and dressing change. September 16th, the patient was taken to the operating room for another wound check and primary closure of the volar incision. Patient was discharged home shortly after the last procedure. The routine visit on October 14th, 2020 with Dr. Smith was noted that the patient's neurological exam noted intact motor and sensation in the axillary nerve distribution of the left upper extremity. The patient had no motor or sensory functional distal to the axillary nerve distribution. On October 20th, 2020, the patient underwent an evaluation with a neurologist and who performed an EMG and nerve conduction study. It should be noted that the auxiliary nerve showed no function. During the ensuing months, the patient underwent work for occupational therapy and physical therapy. Some intervention for pain management was instituted by her primary care. On January 25th, 2021, the neurologist performed a repeat EMG nerve conduction study, which revealed subtle improvement of the motor response in the left deltoid and triceps. No improvement of almost entire brachial plexus. On April 22nd, the patient underwent a Doppler study for her vascular system, the upper extremity. Total occlusion of the left subclavian artery was noted. The patient had some collateral flow in the arm with very poor flow in the left hand. On April 22nd, was seen in a follow-up by the vascular surgeon. Purpose was to discuss amputation and prosthesis placement postoperatively. A referral to Mayo Clinic plastic surgeon was discussed. On May 17th, 2021, patient underwent upper extremity amputation postoperatively. There were some issues with cellulitis and possible failure of the vascular graft. According to the records, the patient stopped seeing Dr. Smith in November of 2020. And I can go into the noted deviations of the standard care if you'd like to do that later.
That's okay. Yes, we can hold off on that. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. I appreciate that complicated report. Don't mean to be rude by correcting you, but it's our jobs as doctors to say all those things right. You're doing great for a non-doctor. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Would you like to swear the doctor in? Or have the doctor sworn in, I should say?
Yes, I'll have Ms. Castro do that.
Dr. Smith, will you please raise your right hand? Will you please unmute your microphone, sir?
Can you hear me?
Yes, sure we can. Hear you. Go ahead, Ms. Castro.
Thank you. Dr. Smith, do you swear under penalty of perjury to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Smith. Would you like to introduce your counsel?
Yeah, this is Robert Stoltz. Good morning, everybody.
Good morning. Pleasure to meet you. Dr. Smith, would you like to introduce yourself? Tell us a little bit about the type of practice you do before proceeding.
Yes, I would. My name is Andrew Smith. I'm a board-certified orthopedic surgeon. I practice in Tucson. I've been here for the last just about 7 years. I'm from Michigan. I completed my undergraduate studies at Michigan State University, my medical school at Michigan State, the Osteopathic Medical School. Completed my residency at Beaumont Hospital in Farmington Hills, Michigan, and then I completed a sports orthopedic surgery fellowship in Cincinnati, Ohio. After all my training, I moved out to Tucson, and that's my first job in practice. My current practice, I would say, consists mainly of a general orthopedic surgery practice with a sports medicine focus, but I do a variety of different orthopedic surgeries, including arthroscopic surgery. But probably the vast majority of my surgeries are shoulder replacements, knee replacements, hip replacements. I take call at the hospital, fix fractures. Originally I was interested in orthopedics. I just had a love of science, loved anatomy. My grandfather had gotten knee replacements. I saw what a difference it made in his life and his function, and ultimately inspired me to want to go into a similar sort of field and really try to help people and improve their quality of life. And I know obviously we're here regarding patient SK, and I'm happy to, obviously she's had a significant complication as a result of the surgery that I performed, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have about it.
That's perfect. And Mr. Bohol, do we have anybody representing or is SK here?
I do not have that patient signed in to speak, but I'll ask, is there anyone present for the patient in this matter? I'm not seeing anybody.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Is there anything else? Yes.
I apologize for interrupting, but before we get started, may I make a brief statement as well?
Oh, yes. I wasn't there yet, but that's fine. Did you have anything else you'd like to tell us about the case, Dr. Smith? Otherwise, your attorney is welcome to speak. If you want your attorney to speak first, that's okay. I'm not trying to push you.
No, I guess.
Good morning, members of the board. Thank you for taking this matter under consideration today and allowing us both the opportunity to make brief comments before we begin. As has been laid out, this case is about a complication that occurred during a left total shoulder orthoplasty performed by Dr. Smith. Immediately after the complication was identified by Dr. Smith and a vascular surgeon during a follow-up surgery, Dr. Smith took immediate responsibility for what had happened, told SK about the complication and what had happened, and communicated that with her family that was participating in her care. And throughout the remainder of Dr. Smith's care of SK, he maintained consistent and open communication with them through office visits, telephone calls, text messages, which we submitted to the board in our initial response. Even after SK stopped receiving care from Dr. Smith, he still helped out where he could. At one point, the vascular surgeon who was treating SK came to Dr. Smith and asked him for help in locating a surgeon who would be able to perform the amputation. And Dr. Smith was happy to assist in that manner because he wanted to help SK in any way that he could. I want to talk just briefly about the medical consultant's report because I think there's some pretty significant issues there that we have raised in response to that. We were quite concerned when we received the medical consultant's report because on reviewing it, we identified a number of inaccuracies that led to some unfortunate conclusions that were not really based on the factual circumstances of this case. So we retained an expert to review the care as well, and we submitted a rebuttal report from Dr. Jeffrey Abrams of Stanford University School of Medicine. In his report, he laid out about 5 pages of rebuttal opinions. I'm obviously not going to go through those in my brief comments here, but there's 2 areas I wanted to highlight. One is the preoperative care. The medical consultant identified 2 areas where he felt the preoperative care fell below standard. One was the supposed lack of an X-ray, and the other was the supposed lack of conservative treatment prior to surgery. With respect to the X-ray, in the rebuttal report, Dr. Abrams has stated that not obtaining an X-ray is not below the standard of care if you have an MRI. But that's really a moot point here because, as pointed out in my June 26 correspondence to the board of this year, there was a preoperative X-ray a couple months prior to the MRI. So that, by all accounts, that standard of care requirement was satisfied. With respect to the conservative treatment, the medical consultant had stated that there was no conservative treatment before proceeding to surgery, and that is factually incorrect. In Dr. Smith's notes, it's noted that the patient had conservative treatment. She went to therapy, did home exercises, had a corticosteroid injection, and took anti-inflammatory medications without any significant relief of her symptoms. And actually, her symptoms had started to progress. So in Dr. Abrams' report, he states that Dr. Smith did comply with the standard of care in the preoperative treatment of SK, and SK was an appropriate candidate for shoulder orthoplasty. The last area with respect to the medical consultant's report that I'd like to address is the mechanism of the complication. And Dr. Smith will be able to talk about this in more technical detail than I am, but in short, the complication occurred when, during the shoulder orthoplasty, the subscapularis tendon has to be released and then subsequently reattached. During the reattachment, a suture went too deep and encircled, encapsulated the neurovascular bundle and constricted it. The medical consultant found that this explanation of the complication not to be believable and used that opinion to question Dr. Smith's knowledge of the anatomy of the shoulder. But as pointed out in Dr. Abrams' rebuttal report, it's actually the medical consultant in his report that makes the mistakes about the anatomy in that area of the shoulder. And in fact, Dr. Abrams stated that this tendon, the subscapularis tendon, lies directly adjacent to the neurovascular bundle, and the neurovascular bundle can be injured when placing stitches in this area. And Dr. Abrams opined that that was the likely cause of this complication. But the board need not rely solely on the medical consultant or Dr. Abrams or even Dr. Smith on this point, because there was a second surgeon in the operating room when that complication was discovered, and that was vascular surgeon Dr. Joshua Baldwin. And he was standing right next to Dr. Smith when they identified the cause of this complication. And Dr. Baldwin separately documented in his operative report that, quote, we found that there was a suture material incarcerating the axillary neurovascular bundle. I highlight these inaccuracies in the medical consultant's report not for the sake of highlighting or picking at inaccuracies, but because these inaccuracies led the medical consultant to conclusions that we feel we've demonstrated were not based on the facts of the case. And it also led the medical consultant to question Dr. Smith's knowledge of the anatomy and his competency to perform shoulder surgeries. And frankly, that is just not a fair or accurate assessment of Dr. Smith. He's a skilled surgeon. He cares deeply for his patients. And the surgery issue in this case took place approximately 1 year after his fellowship. Since the surgery in this case, Dr. Smith has performed about 350 shoulder orthoplasties and has not had a similar complication. And so while we're not saying this to minimize the complication that occurred in this case, but to highlight that this was an isolated incident. Those are my comments, and Dr. Smith is happy to answer any questions that the board may have.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And going back to the beginning of your response there, part of the question of today, of course, is the immediate or timeliness of intervention. But we'll get back to that later, I'm sure. Are there any questions from the board members? Dr. Cunningham?
Don't mind, Dr. Cunningham. I appreciate Dr. Smith and his attorney. I think they've done a very good job of trying to help mitigate this very unfortunate circumstance. What I'd like to ask Dr. Smith is, this was a horrible outcome. You're a new physician, not only a year, and we understand that complications can happen. What have you learned, or what would you have done different from this case that you have before you? You had the same case come before you. What would you do? What would you do? If you could just run that past our board, I'd appreciate it.
Yep, happy to explain some of the changes I've made, things that I've done following this this case. When you're doing a total shoulder replacement, one of the important aspects of that surgery is after the shoulder replacement's been put in is restoring part of the rotator cuff, and that's what the subscapularis tendon is. It's part of the rotator cuff. And there's a couple different techniques to be able to repair that back to the bone. My former technique was I would basically release the tendon off of the bone with like electrocautery or a scalpel. And then after the surgery was completed or the replacement was put in, then suturing the tendon back down to the bone. Since that time, I've modified my technique to perform what's called an osteotomy. So instead of just releasing the tendon, you're actually making a cut in the bone with the tendon attached, and then subsequently repairing that piece of bone with tendon back to the shoulder after the completion. The advantage of doing that in terms of just safety is it's further away from the neurovascular bundle. The other thing that I've done is I think potentially what had occurred was really a result of retractor placements, and being extremely mindful of retractor placements, very important because we know the neurovascular bundle lies closely in proximity to the area that we're working. I've said when we switch to using a different retractor, and also just really making sure that my the assistants that I have in the surgery are just well aware of the proximity to of where we're working to the neurovascular bundle, and just making sure that paying extremely close attention to where we are, making sure that our tissue planes are appropriate for where we're working. After this complication occurred, I had, this was a devastating problem, and I shoulder replacements is one of the things that I really wanted to make a big part of my practice, and I wanted, I felt very capable and confident coming out of all my training. I think this SK case was my 13th shoulder replacement in practice, and I wanted to make sure that moving forward I never had something like this happen again. I reached out to mentors, I reached out to peers, asked their opinion, what can I do, what can I change. I also have gone to several local, let's say like cadaveric dissection courses. Well, I guess it's like an informal course. It's more of like a practicing putting in shoulder replacements with different industry-sponsored events. But the part of that is you're using cadavers to put in those replacements, and at the same time you can spend extra time just performing dissection. So that's I did that right away after just to refamiliarize myself with the anatomy. I maintain good standing with all my CME. I'm regular going to courses, conferences. I also had gone to another. It was a course, like a revision shoulder replacement course, and really focuses on patients who have passed, who have shoulder replacements in place. And the course is meant to revise those shoulder replacements. So it's meant for more complicated, I'd say, form of shoulder replacement. But at the same time, just the dissection is more complicated. The releases and exposure gaining access is more complicated. And I really wanted to make sure that just moving forward, if I ran into a very complicated situation, I was prepared to deal with that. So all of those things in summary are the ways that I've kind of had to adjust my technique and find ways forward to, one, make sure I'm familiar with the anatomy and make sure that I never put someone in a situation like this again.
I appreciate your candor and the behavioral and also interventions that you've done. I am curious about, you said you went to some extra training. I understand this was, industry sponsored. You know that many of us, look at that as always a bias as well, too. You mentioned some other courses that you took, but I'd be more interested to hear about that. I'm glad you did that, but I think that going to a CME with something like Stanford University or any of the large universities that have the type of training of orthopedics that would offer these classes that are non-biased, that's what I call them, they're non-industry, would have been appropriate. Did you do anything of that sort?
I have not gone to any, Orthopedic American Academy Association, specific shoulder replacement course. At the normal, American Osteopathic American or Orthopedic Surgeon conferences, I'm always attending the shoulder and elbow sections of that course, but they're not hands-on. There's more of a lecture-based format at those conferences. So besides the industry-sponsored one, I haven't done an academy type of surgical dissection course.
Okay. That was my question. I appreciate your answers. Thank you, Dr. Maiden.
Thank you, Dr. Cunningham. I appreciate it. Yes, Dr. Chapin, please.
Dr. Smith, thank you for talking to us today. I just had a few questions. You said you wanted to make shoulder replacements more part of your practice, and you've done about 300 since this case. How many arthroplastic shoulder surgeries have you done in that time?
I've done approximately 350 shoulder replacements since this complication occurred. And that's a combination of total shoulder and reverse total shoulder, which to me, that's essentially it's the same exact approach. It's just the implants that you put in are different implants. But the surgery is essentially the same. The structures are the same. So it's been 350 since that time.
And I apologize. How many scopes have you done? How many have you decided not to do a shoulder replacement and do an end scope?
I do both arthroscopic and the open total shoulder replacements. How many arthroscopic surgeries?
Yep.
I don't know the exact number off the top of my head. Many more than, if I had a guess, I'd say probably 600 shoulder arthroscopic surgeries since that time.
Okay. And so in this case, what made you decide to go, I'm just trying to understand the rationale between going with that was your 13th replacement, going through a replacement surgery versus doing a scope on that patient with the MRI findings and the x-ray findings. What was your thoughts on that case?
So based on the MRI findings, she had significant arthritis in her shoulder. Initially, when I was evaluating her initially, she'd come to me with two problems. One was her knee, one was her shoulder. Her knee was the worst problem, so we were working on that first, but kind of like while working on that, also kind of treating her for her shoulder at the same time. When I originally reviewed the MRI and evaluated her, it led me to have the impression that potentially this is more of like a soft tissue problem. And I would say, meaning potentially if surgical treatment was required, it would be potentially more of like an arthroscopic surgery. I think that throughout my subsequent exams with her, and when we were really at the point of deciding, okay, we're ready for your shoulder, we're ready to work on your shoulder. You know, you've tried everything, it's not working. What are we going to do? And after really scrutinizing the MRI, to me, it was clear that the major problem with your shoulder was really the arthritis. So that's ultimately why we had the discussion of proceeding with the shoulder replacement as opposed to like an arthroscopic surgery. It's just that if we only had done an arthroscopic surgery, it wouldn't be the appropriate surgery to her because she would have the potential for still having significant pain and ultimately requiring probably replacement down the road. So for me, it was pretty obvious that a shoulder replacement was in her best interest.
So from the MRI, I'm just a little confused medically. From the MRI, there's tendon tears. What about the MRI made you think that there was a lot of arthritis contributing on that MRI findings to replace that shoulder? If you could clarify.
So she had findings of chondromalacia within the glenohumeral joint. Which was considered like grade 3 or grade 4, which grade 4 is essentially bare bone, like there's no cartilage left. The grade 3 is you have high grade cartilage loss, like at least 50 to 75% of the cartilage is gone. She also had, at least on her physical exam, she had limited range of motion or stiffness in her shoulder, which is one of, I'd say, classic findings of shoulder arthritis. When I'm evaluating for someone for a shoulder replacement, it's really looking at multiple different things. You know, you're looking at the patient themselves and their health status. You're looking at their physical exam. You're trying to put together the imaging, trying to figure out how bad is this problem and what they've been through already to try to make it better. So to me, after scrutinizing the MRI, it was clear that the shoulder arthritis was her what putting everything together, it was clear that the shoulder arthritis seemed to be contributing the most to her symptoms.
Okay. And you said, and I think your attorney said that as far as conservative treatment, an injection was tried prior to?
Yes.
How many was did you do the injection or was that sent to?
So she had come to me with x-rays and MRI already had ordered by another physician. And she had already had some conservative treatment. I had performed a cortisone injection for her. And I believe I only had performed one. And she had temporary short-term relief from that. But she also had a course of physical therapy that was performed. I believe that it was under the assumption that she, and I did not order that physical therapy. She had, I think it was under the assumption she had like a frozen shoulder. But she nonetheless did not respond to the physical therapy. But when I had seen her, she, you know, I had instructed her on home exercises to be doing and a stretching program for her shoulder. She still was taking anti-inflammatory medication and Tylenol, you know, trying to modify some of her activities to try and reduce her symptoms.
Okay. And so you did, and just so your practice, when you do cortisone injections, do you do them with image guidance or no?
I do not use like an ultrasound to do injections. But that is I'd say my common practice to always offer non-surgical treatment to people. I really only look at shoulder replacements as being like a last option for people. She had certainly in my eyes, it was affecting her quality of life, her regular activities. She was becoming, she was having pain at nights, couldn't sleep because of it. And on top of that, already attempted the conservative treatment. You know, I do think that there should be a limit to conservative treatment if you can see it's kind of going in the wrong direction or if someone is failing to have long-term response to things like an injection. But so there, in general, the goal would not be to just do injection after injection after injection for years as a long-term strategy of treating shoulder arthritis.
Sure. But yeah, I mean, certainly a decent trial of conservative treatment would be warranted, correct? And reasonable and specific, I would say. So you proceeded with the shoulder replacement. And then can you talk a little bit more about the follow-up? I guess there was some with the follow-up in the hospital and then the follow-up in your office as far as the documentation of the exam and what was found and what was done.
So, yes, happy to. So when I did the shoulder replacement, the time of the operation, things to me went well. It seemed like a routine replacement. It really didn't struggle. After the surgery, at that time, it was kind of considered standard to stay one night in the hospital at least, and then the next day go home. I went and saw her early in the morning the next day. When I examined her in the hospital, she still did not have any sensation in her hands. And she didn't have any, or in her upper extremity and her motor, she didn't have any motor function yet. And at that time, I palpated pulses and her hand was warm. When I essentially, it looked like a fairly normal post-operative visit day one after a shoulder replacement. I had documented that she, had no motor, no sensation, and I attributed that to the nerve block. That she had from the surgery itself still working, because I've seen other patients having a nerve block that lasts longer than potentially like the average, and that did not strike me as concerning at all. I think in the hospital she worked with an occupational therapist while she was there, and then ultimately prior to discharge she had a nurse in the hospital document pulses in her arm, and she was discharged home. I think it was 2 days later, I got a call that she was in the hospital with a pulseless arm, and her shoulder was dislocated now. I came right to the hospital, and as I was essentially me and a vascular surgeon, that was a call. We took her right back into the operating room because she did not have pulses. at the time, he attempted to pass a catheter up through the brachial artery and his axillary artery to try and thinking there was potentially a clot, and he couldn't pass the catheter. And when that happened, I opened up the shoulder, and sure enough, we looked down, and you can see that there's a stitch encircling the neurovascular bundle. We release the stitch. He's able to reperfuse and revascularize your arm. At that time, to help reduce the risk of a reperfusion injury, I ended up performing fasciotomies on her upper extremity to try to prevent the risk of developing like a rhabdomyolysis or compartment syndrome. So I performed the fasciotomies. She's in the hospital for, I think, approximately 20 days after that. And throughout that period of time, I'm intermittently every 2-3 days taking her back to operating room to perform irrigation debridements and gradually close these fasciotomy sites, because there's so much swelling early on, you don't necessarily close those incisions, but as the swelling goes down, you gradually are able to close those. She followed up with me after discharge. She eventually followed up with me at the office, and we monitored her incisions, monitored her wounds. I got her into physical therapy and occupational therapy right away. I had eventually ordered an EMG to try and determine the extent of the neurological injury of her arm, which the EMG showed that she had essentially a complete brachial plexus injury. My plan eventually was to try and get her evaluated for potential nerve transfers down the road. When we had a second EMG that showed that there was no recovery in the nerve, that was still my plan, but that was the last time that I had seen her. And then I believe that it was, and that's why I'd seen her for about 3 months after the surgery, following her along and counseling her through that. And then eventually she, I think it was about 9 months later, she was having problems with her the vascular procedure that had been performed on her arm, and it was starting to fail. At some point it got infected, it got occluded, and she was starting to get some gangrene in her fingers and necrosis at her fingertips, and the patient ultimately decided to elect to undergo an amputation. So, but I was, at that point, about 9 months after the last time I had seen her, I wasn't really involved in her care. All I did is I helped make a recommendation of which doctor to go see for the amputation. I guess they were having a hard time finding anyone that would care for her. So when I went and found someone and told the vascular surgeon to go, send her to this surgeon, he can help. And that's where she went, and that's where she had the operation.
Okay. Just one more. Are there any documentation of any physical exam that are inaccurate in your, when you reviewed the medical records, or are they all accurate as they were those days?
In that you examined? Follow-up visits there?
Correct. In the follow-ups after the initial surgery?
I believe that they're accurate.
You're accurate. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate it, Dr. Chapon. So Dr. Smith, going back to post-op day one, is it typical to discharge a patient before regaining neurologic function? I understand that was a block, of course, and your time frame is usually measured in hours for that. Is that typically 6-8 hours? Is that more towards the normal time frame for the shoulder block maintain no neurologic function?
So typically the nerve blocks that we're doing for shoulder arthroplasties on it, what I routinely hear from anesthesiologists performing the blocks, and in my own experience, is that on average they last about 18 hours, and sometimes it's less, sometimes it's more. I've had patients tell me they've had a nerve block last for 2 days after the surgery. I have in my own discharge instructions that at that time, if basically you're still having numbness or weakness in your hand, and it's been more than 48 hours, like, you need to call and let us know right away. So I had mentioned that it was routine at that time in 2020 that patients, from an insurance standpoint, it was required they stay in the hospital for the night and then go home. Nowadays, all of the shoulder replacements that we do are all outpatient. So we are routinely sending people home, an hour and a half after they hit the recovery room after a shoulder replacement, and they're getting discharged home and their arm is completely insensate and motorless. That is currently that is what is happening. So, you know, I would say that discharging someone home without neurological function really is pretty common right now.
And you mentioned the hand being warm on post-op day one and the nurse documenting pulses. I did not see, and I might have missed it, but did you document on post-op day one pulses or capillary refill?
Yes, I did.
And going back to October 14, I don't know if that's what Dr. Chapin was asking about. You had neurologic examination normal with intact radial pulses, but on October 20, the patient went to neurology and noted that we had the complete and severe brachial plexopathy. Do you think that could have deteriorated in that amount of time?
The date you said was October 14th?
Correct. I saw an examination from you October 14 with neuro exam normal and pulses intact. Do I remember that correctly? I think I got that, Mr. Bohol, correct?
That is correct.
If you wouldn't mind, I'd like to review that record if possible.
Of course. I don't have the page number in front of me. I'm sorry.
I believe I have it here.
Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
This is October 14th. Okay. Yes, that's October 14th.
Good. Keep me honest. Okay, take a look.
It says in the neurological exam, it says motor/sensory is intact in the axillary nervous sensory dermatome. Motor and sensory is not intact in the median ulnar radial posterior interosseous, anterior interosseous, and musculocutaneous nervous distribution. And she had palpable pulses. And because that was after she had had her vascular, like, reperfusion stenting procedure performed.
Okay, that's helpful. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I don't have any other questions or any other questions from the board. So Dr. Smith, we obviously have a very grave outcome, and there were concerns from the outside medical consultant, obviously some of that evidenced biologically by the bad outcome. So the question is, what do we need to do as a medical board to fulfill our primary charter to protect the public? I certainly do not personally feel revocation, suspension, or limitation of privileges is necessary. I just want to make sure the rest of the board agrees with me on that. It looks like the rest of the board agrees. That's fantastic. No, I appreciate it. The question is, does this raise to the level of something punitive, or is this non-punitive? Do I have an opinion from the other board members?
Dr. Maiden, like, this is a very complicated case. This is a never event. And it's a very unfortunate outcome. He seems to have demonstrated some, you know, he's done multiple surgeries since then, over 300. But in this particular case, it was a very poor outcome. I'm not sure what direction. I lean towards a decree of censure, but on the other hand, though, he has to demonstrate that he's moved forward with doing other procedures, and they have now streamlined those procedures, as he's telling us now, where they send patients home now. They don't even keep them overnight anymore. But in this case, it was a horrible event for this patient, just a horrible event. So I'm betwixt, to be honest with you.
I totally understand, Dr. Cunningham. Dr. Chapin?
I do. I'm in that realm as well. I did have some. I was considering having asking for an executive session for legal advice regarding some of the I apologize, the the ARS citations. I just wanted to clarify a couple of those before we made a final decision, if that's before we do that. There was some question. But yeah, I do think that this is a, I mean, I appreciate your ability to, you know, to discuss this situation candidly and to learn from it. And I certainly understand, you know, being new out of training, I do think that possibly some additional CME would be warranted, as Dr. Cunningham had discussed, in the realm of something with accreditation as opposed to industry-sponsored, just to learn from an unbiased standpoint and certainly from your colleagues and peers so that you can succeed and continue to take care of patients in Arizona. So.
I agree with that. I do like that Dr. Smith did mention changing procedures to get a little bit more distance from the neurovascular bundle. I appreciate your bone approach instead of the tendon approach, Dr. Smith. That being said, I'd like to make a motion to move to executive session.
Second.
For legal advice, I apologize. Thank you. If none opposed, all in favor, aye.
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 All yours, Mr. Bohol. We'll be right back, Dr. Smith, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you. Okay, thank you.
believe you have your quorum, sir.
Thank you very much. Any additional questions for Dr. Schultz? Any other details Dr. Smith or Mr. Schultz would like to mention? I think you're muted, Mr. Schultz. God bless technology. Dr. Cunningham, you need to send your IT specialist over there. She'd be good for you.
Okay. I apologize for the technical issue. Technology is what it is. We do not have any further comments. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do I have a motion?
I'd like to make a motion. Motion for a decree of censure, citing ARS 32-1854-6, engaging in the practice of medicine that harms or may harm a patient that the board determines falls below the community standard. ARS 32-1854-19, committing any conduct or practice contrary to the recognized standards of ethics of the osteopathic medical profession. ARS 32-1854-20, violating or attempt to violate directly or indirectly or assisting or abetting the violation or of conspiracy to violate any of the provisions of the chapter. And 32-1854-39, any conduct or practice that endangers patient or the public health or may reasonably be expected to do so. Dr. Smith, I appreciate your ability to make some change in your practice. However, I'm still have some concern with the decision-making and proceeding with total arthroscopic procedures versus more conservative treatments. And the ability to have an unbiased opinion with them, considering your training with the industry-sponsored courses that you're taking. And so in addition to I'd like to add a CME to be determined. Sorry, can you hear me okay? And that's breaking up on
my
end.
Yes,
okay. Thank you. So CME around the hours of 20 hours requiring prior approval of the executive director, something like American Academy of Orthopedic Surgeon type course, discussing indications and procedure techniques for total shoulder arthroplasty, something in that realm.
Second thing.
Okay.
Motion. Sorry, go ahead. Yes.
Sorry about that. Allison. So we clarify, is the CME disciplinary or non-disciplinary?
Disciplinary.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
We have a motion on a second on the floor. Any other discussion? I would just like to open discussion for myself with if this motion does not pass, I would like to make the motion with the same responses except as administrative warning. But that's my only other discussion. Mr. Bohol, I believe it's a roll call vote.
That is correct. So the motion and the second roll call, Dr. Cunningham.
Yes.
Dr. Shippong.
Yes.
Dr. Matem.
No.
Motion carries.
It does carry. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. Dr. Smith, you can get a hold of Mr. Bohol and staff after meeting for discussion of details. I definitely appreciate what you've done in the meantime over the last, I believe it's been 6 years, and we look forward to never having to see you again. I don't mean that in a rude way. I
appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Thank you, Mr. Schultz.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Board, are we in a position? You can bring Mr. Goodman back. I'm sorry. Are we in a position to continue on, or do we need a biologic?
Biologic, please.
Okay.
From
10 minutes?
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. I'll see everybody in 10 minutes. Thank you.
Justin, could you please enable my video?
Yes, I can do that. Sorry. Welcome back.
Welcome back, Mr. Goodman.
Happy to be here.
You do have your quorum if you'd like to resume.
Well, let's resume then. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see, where are we going to next? We're on item 6, is that correct, Mr. Bohol?
Yep, 6A, case number DO260136A, Lynn Perry. I believe the doctor signed in, and I will have Ms. Castro provide the summary.
Thank you very much. Go ahead, Ms. Castro.
Yeah. Dr. Lynn Perry has applied for licensure January 14th of 2026. On her application, Dr. Perry properly disclosed a felony conviction, disciplinary action, a previous license revocation in Arizona, and a prior license denial, as well as a probationary status during her residency training. A history of the license is as follows. Dr. Perry was issued an Arizona osteopathic license July 2nd of 1982. She was board certified in family medicine in 1996. The Arizona board placed her license on probation in October 2003 due to inappropriate prescribing. The probation was lifted January 2005. In March 2008, after receiving notification that Dr. Perry was under investigation by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, the board initiated a complaint investigation. As a result of the DEA's investigation, Dr. Perry pled guilty to distribution of human growth hormone, a Class D felony, in July 2009. Around October 2010, the case was heard at the Office of Administrative Hearings, and the ALJ Administrative Law Judge recommended the revocation of the license. The license was revoked at that time. In January 2014, Dr. Perry applied for licensure with the Arizona Board. The application was ultimately denied in March 2016. Staff notes that during the review of the application, the board found evidence that Dr. Perry was practicing osteopathic medicine without a license. Dr. Perry is again applying for a full license to re-enter clinical practice and has provided a proposed re-entry to practice plan, including supervision. Dr. Perry has not held another license to practice. The board has been provided a list of potential statute violations for review, and among them include ARS 32-1854-6, engaging in the practice of medicine in a manner that harms or may harm a patient or that the board determines falls below the community standard, 1854-18, having a license denied or disciplinary action taken against a license by another state, territory, district, or country, 1854-19, committing any conduct or practice contrary to recognized standards of ethics of the osteopathic medical profession, and 1854-46, committing conduct in the practice of medicine that evidences unfitness to practice medicine.
Thank you very much, Ms. Castro. I appreciate that. And thank you for being here, Doctor. So obviously these are all concerning items on the list, a felony conviction, probation, concerns for prescribing, practicing without a license. I just want to ask you a quick question. You heard in the beginning of this meeting, I'm sure, that the object of this board, our charter, is to protect the public. In what way do you think we could reasonably think the public is safe with these problems that have been before us before?
Dr. Madam, have we sworn in Dr. Perry?
Do we have to swear in for initial license applications? I'm sorry.
No, not for an it's not an investigative hearing.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, no, you keep me honest, Ms. Franklin.
And Dr. Perry, if you could unmute your microphone.
You got it.
Can you hear me okay?
Yes, perfect. Please go ahead.
Would you repeat your question, please?
So the charter, the object of this board is to protect the public. There have been some obvious problems identified in the past and a series of problems, including a felony conviction with the prescribing practices and practicing without a license. These are all items that this board has to use as indicators that it might be not safe for you to practice in the state of Arizona, which is what we have to do for protecting the public. So can you help me understand how we could say it is reasonably safe for the public for us to consider a license for you?
Would it be appropriate for me to give my statement that would include my rehabilitation to a safer, more acceptable perspective on practicing medicine?
Exactly, that would. Please go ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for granting me this opportunity to address the board. I am fully responsible for my actions that led to my poorly informed decision to prescribe human growth hormone off-label. And this, of course, compelled the board eventually to revoke my osteopathic medical license. I violated the law, and I've spent several years now reflecting on the cognitive error in medical decision-making. While attending the PACE, the Physician Assessment and Continuing Education course at UC San Diego, I heard other physicians who, like me, were undergoing difficulties with their boards. They were vigorously blaming the board and everyone else for their problems, and they were going to sue everybody. And suddenly my own blind spot was revealed to me, that I was just like them. It was a very shameful realization. But it served as a wake-up moment that flaws in my judgment that I made were now becoming painfully obvious. The board wasn't misunderstanding me. Rather, I was misunderstanding my professional responsibilities in medical decision-making. And this changed my focus from attempting to defend my conduct to understanding why I did it. What was going on in my head that would make me make these kinds of irresponsible decisions, and ensuring, finding a way that it would never happen again? Violating the law is straightforward, but understanding how I arrived is more nuanced, and it took some time, because that's really important. Finally, I realized I went with my desire rather than the facts. I allowed my unbridled enthusiasm for an emerging field, the anti-aging one, to let confirmation bias, what everybody else is thinking, and opinions of respected colleagues in it, to replace my own obligation to independently evaluate scientific evidence and the legal framework governing medical practice. I failed to apply a level of skepticism and independent legal analysis that I now believe that we all should exercise. My judgment today is built on lessons learned through this very painful experience. I do not rely on expert opinion alone. I have to get busy and independently review the medical literature and the statistical methods that are used in those studies and what they submitted to the FDA for approval, if there is any, and the data, the quality of data submitted. If there's uncertainty, I seek clarification now, not assurance. Good intentions do not excuse poor judgment. I'm no longer swayed by confirmation bias or authority bias or group consensus. In fact, I look for evidence now concerning my own biases that actually will challenge it rather than confirming it. Fundamentally, I've changed the way I think about medicine and how I approach medical decisions. And it's more than just helping patients. It's a disciplined adherence to scientific evidence and regulatory requirements, and the awareness of professional humility that a physician can make a serious error in judgment, despite good intentions, to never substitute consensus for my own independent responsibility to understand both the science and the law. When I fully understood what I had been doing in prescribing HGH and how illegal it was, I mean, I didn't even want to look at the law. That's how blind I was. My immediate response to the DEA was to offer my cooperation if needed. I was really ashamed that I'd broken the law. I desperately wanted to show my respect for the law and for the DEA. And at the request, I became an undercover operative to assist the DEA investigation of the pharmacy that had sold me the HGH. There was something much greater going on. And this was done without any offer for a reduction in punishment or any other considerations. The greatest change in my behavior and medical decision-making approach came from working in the emerging field of stem cells. I didn't yield to pressure any longer, and I wasn't going to adopt the prevailing opinion, often commercially inspired. I didn't accept claims of what they could do at face value. I demanded the scientific evidence. I asked if legal implications were known. If not, I sought them. And at times there was an obvious ethical, legal, or scientific conflict, and I walked away. The most important lesson I learned was that my error was not simply a legal mistake. It was a failure in my medical decision-making process. I respectfully ask for the second chance, the privilege, and opportunity to earn back the trust of the board, the osteopathic community, and my future patients through the careful, ethical, evidence-based practice of osteopathic medicine on a part-time basis and gradually getting to a full-time if appropriate, under whatever reasonable conditions the board determines to be appropriate. Thank you. I'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Any further questions from the board?
No, sir.
I'm sorry, I'm talking to the board. One moment, Doctor.
Doctor,
you look like you have a question.
Dr. Day, it's okay, Dr. Cunningham, is that all right if I speak? I really don't have any other questions. I appreciate this applicant's honesty, and I'm glad that she's found some what appears to be closure and clarity. That still doesn't negate the fact that the accident happened in the past. And these were very serious, inappropriate prescribing. She'd been on probation before. And also then practicing without a license, lastly. And so with all of those in Paris, and she has not practiced any medicine for over 10 years, clearly, I don't believe this is a person that we could re-enter in. I don't see a path forward with this way of protecting the public, allowing this applicant to move forward at this time.
May I withdraw my application at this time?
We lost Dr. Mayhem.
Yeah, I'm sorry, hold on.
I apologize, Dr. Cunningham. I lost connectivity for just a moment there. You were just talking about not practicing for 10 years. I apologize. Do you mind summarizing that for me?
Sure. I'll go back here again. She is our, this applicant has already asked if she could remove her application after my statement. So would you like me to still repeat it again?
Not if the physician wishes to withdraw her application. Mr. Bohol, do you need anything further from us for withdrawn application?
If she's requesting to withdraw, if the board has no further action, then we can close the case.
I see no need for any further action unless anybody else has any concerns from the board. I see no further concerns. You may go ahead, Mr. Bohol.
We will draw the application.
Thank you very much.
The board would like to move on to item 6B. I believe this is case number DO-260107A, Elizabeth Legomo, or Legomo. And we'll have the doctor sign. I believe the doctor is present. Yes.
Perfect. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Castro, are you presenting this?
Yes, I will have Ms. Castro present.
Perfect. Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
Dr. Legalbo has applied for licensure in June 2005. During the processing of the application, Dr. Legalbo was notified by staff that she failed to disclose a malpractice payment made on her behalf, as well as failed to disclose a disciplinary action taken on her license by another state. The application was ultimately withdrawn for failure to complete within the time frame allowed. Dr. Legalbo has again applied for licensure. On the application, Dr. Legalbo answered no to having had any disciplinary or adverse action imposed on her license and having any award, settlement, or payment of any kind made on her behalf. The New York State Board of Medicine placed the doctor's license on probation March of 2004. The probation required monitored supervised practice and probation was terminated March 2007. The probation was a result of the board's investigation into allegations that Dr. Legalbo was not seeing her hospitalized patients daily. The doctor stated she was performing her patient rounds early Saturday morning and again Sunday evenings, and concerns of her schedule were reported to the Department of Health. The malpractice payment was made on behalf of Dr. Legalbo for a delay in diagnosis in 2010. The payment was for $600,000. Dr. Legalbo stated that the patient was seen exclusively by a physician assistant and her role was limited to co-signing the care provided. The patient was a 56-year-old male who was seen for complaints of sinus pressure pain and back pain. After various prescriptions for anti-inflammatory and non-steroidal drugs, the patient was found to have a compression fracture of T12. He later suffered cardiac arrest with resuscitation. The patient was admitted with renal failure, diagnosed with multiple myeloma, and ultimately passed. When notified again by staff that she had failed to disclose properly and had provided false or misleading information, Dr. Legalbo stated that she had inadvertently not disclosed. Additionally, the doctor stated she did not fully appreciate the malpractice event required disclosure, as her direct involvement in the patient's care was limited to co-signing the treatment plan. Dr. Legalbo held a license in Michigan, which has lapsed, and currently holds licenses in Hawaii and New York with no other disciplinary action. The board staff notes a concern in that Dr. Legalbo repeatedly failed to disclose and therefore provided false or misleading information on multiple applications. Additionally, staff notes a concern that the conduct resulting in the malpractice payment is not reviewed by the state of New York. The board has been provided a list of potential statute violations for review, and among them include 32.18.54.9, procuring, renewing, or attempting to procure or renew a license to practice osteopathic medicine by fraud or misrepresentation, 18.54.18, having a license denied or disciplinary action taken against a license by another state, 18.54.19, committing any conduct or practice contrary to recognized standards of ethics, and 32.18.22.A6, having not engaged in any conduct that, if occurred in this state, would be considered unprofessional conduct.
Thank you very much, Ms. Castro. And I'm sorry, ma'am, do I pronounce it Dr. Legalbo?
Yes, Legalbo.
Legalbo? It's a pleasure to meet you. Thank you. Would you like to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about these events?
Yes, thank you for the interview. I appreciate it. Yes, I started to apply to Arizona in June of last year. And on the initial application, I tried to answer all the questions best I knew. Usually I have reapplications and insurance applications that ask if you've had anything within the last 5 or 10 years. So I just assumed that this application was the same. That's why I initially put no. That was the first time I tried to apply. The second time I tried to apply, I did send everything to the board, actually in writing, from the Department of Health, from the lawyers who took care of the malpractice case. And unfortunately, that wasn't accepted, and I didn't know how to do a PDF. So the second time I applied, it did not go through. So in November of 2025, I hired a medical licensing company to help me do all this. And at that point, they proceeded to give everything that they could possibly find and make the application as best they could. However, I graduated from Michigan State in 1989 and board certified in 1992. So I actually did internship at Flint Osteopathic Hospital. And the ability to find all these documentations, because they wouldn't accept my diploma, was very difficult, not only for me, but also for the licensing company. So through all this time, actually after they were trying for 6 months, two more application trials and four fingerprints and background checks later, I finally got my application in with all the appropriate documentation of the incidents that happened back in early 2000. The malpractice case happened when I was co-signing for a nurse practitioner who had seen a person for back pain after he was moving some musical instruments for his daughter. And they came in, they saw the nurse practitioner, they did some tests. They also had a sinus infection. The patient actually came back to the office, and it was documented, and he had no more back pain. So there was no more discussion. After a little while, I think it was a few months, he had a cardiac problem. He went to the emergency room, and he was admitted into the intensive care unit where he actually had cardiac arrest. And they resuscitated him. And after they resuscitated him, they found out that he had multiple myeloma as well and a compression fracture. So this never went to court. There were no court documents, so I could not disclose any court documents because there weren't. It was settled out of court. For $600,000. For the Department of Health, what happened with that was in about 1998, I was the medical commander of an Army MASH unit. And my duties were weekends, usually, very early in the morning through the weekend, having to take care of the medical unit. So I would do rounds like at 3, 4 o'clock in the morning in my BDUs or uniform and was not really seen, by the nursing staff. They were not at the nursing station or whatever, but I saw my patients and I documented everything. I'd even go down to physical therapy to try to find them if they weren't in their room to go and see them and write the note. It was the time when we all wrote notes. There was no Epic or Dragon or anything like that. So I would see the patients. Well, the nurses said that I wasn't seeing the patients. And actually one time I remember that I was doing rounds and I was writing the note at the nurse's station and the nurse came up to me and said, so-and-so says that he didn't see you. And I said, I just saw so-and-so. And so we both went to the room and I asked the patient, I said, did you just see me? And they go, yeah, we just saw you, but you're not Dr. Rezl. That's my maiden name. It was Rezl at the time. And I'm like, they were expecting my father. I was in practice with my father and my uncle, both Dr. Rezls. So they didn't, even though I introduced myself, he didn't think that I was the doctor. So I said, thank you very much. And I said, looked at the nurse and I said, everything okay? And then I went back to the nurse's station and filled out the report. So with that being said, after that, my uncle retired and my dad had an aneurysm, which kind of left me doing everything, hospital rounds and the office. So I had hired in 1999 a hospitalist to help take over the office. In the year 2000, I was told that I had a Department of Health inquiry toward my practice and not seeing patients. And over the next 3 years, the Department of Health came and looked at every single office note. They took boxes of my charts. They looked at all my hospital records. And in 2003, they stated that I had a failure to document an adequate medical history, and subsequently gave me a probation of 3 years where I had to go to a 2-week CME conference course and pass it. And I got fifth in the class. And then I had to go for a mental evaluation to make sure that I was mentally sound. And I also had to go to have a physician come to my office once a week to look at all the charts that I had done over the week to make sure that I was accurately documenting my work. After that was completed in 2007, the probation was lifted, and that was the end of that. Since then, I continued to work in New York, of course, unrestricted. My DEA was never taken away from me. My New York license was never taken away from me. My husband and I were not tolerating the winters in New York anymore, so we decided to go to Hawaii. We got married in Hawaii, and so we decided to apply to Hawaii, and I applied to Hawaii with all the documentation of the Department of Health and the malpractice suit and everything like that, and Hawaii gave me my Hawaii license. And since 2017 or 18, I have been practicing unrestricted in Hawaii with no problems. And I still hold my New York license. I did not keep my Michigan license. I graduated in Michigan. I did my residencies in Michigan. But after that, I wasn't planning to go back to Michigan, so I let my Michigan license lapse.
Perfect. Go ahead. Go ahead. I apologize.
Okay, sorry. I currently work on a little island in Hawaii called Lanai. I am one of two physicians, no specialists on the island. We take care of approximately 3,000 patients here. We do it all. I'm family practice from prenatal to geriatrics, minor urgent care, because we don't have anything except a little hospital here with a two-bed, 24-hour hold. And if anyone needs to do anything more than that, they helicopter them out. So I like the underserved. I like taking care of rural. I've always been rural. And I would like to move to Arizona and continuing practicing medicine. And that's it, I think.
Thank you very much, ma'am. I appreciate it. Do we have any questions from the board?
No, I think she's adequately explained everything. I'm not sure why she'd want to leave Hawaii and have to dry Arizona, but welcome to coming to that 150-degree weather that we're having.
Well, it's not about the weather. It's really about the expense. My family, my granddaughter is now going to be 9, and it's just too expensive for everyone to visit. And my husband and I are pretty lonely for family, and Arizona is kind of midway and close to Vegas, which everyone goes to Vegas, so they're more apt to come visit us, and it's a little less expensive for them to come see us. So that's kind of why we picked Arizona. We have friends in Arizona and some family there. My husband's ex-military, 23 years Army, so he's got some military friends there that he actually is there now seeing. So it's a state that I thought that I would, and I like the heat. I'm sorry. It's for me, Hawaii is a little moist. So with all the rain, and that type of thing, but you know, I that's why we picked Arizona.
All right. Thank you very much. I don't have any further questions, Dr. Megan.
Thank you very much, Dr. Cunningham. Any other questions from the board? I just have a question or two for you, ma'am. In 2021 was the nursing practitioner event, is that correct?
No. 1998.
Thank you. Yeah. So in 1998, was the nursing practitioner practicing under their own license, or what was the purpose of you co-signing those notes?
No, they were actually, I did not start out supervising any nurse practitioner or PA. My father and uncle were involved with that. But when my father had an aneurysm and he couldn't return to work, I took over the responsibility of supervision of the nurse practitioners.
No, I'm sorry, different question there. So the physician assistants are practicing under your license, under your supervision. Nursing practitioners, do they have autonomy, or did they have autonomy to practice under their own license in New York at that time? I don't know.
No.
Question.
No, neither the physician assistant or nurse practitioners had autonomy, and they had to be supervised. Like I said, I did not supervise either physician assistants or nurse practitioners until after my father went into the hospital.
So just to be clear, if you're supervising and only co-signing notes, are you then not supervising? You're just signing a note, correct?
Oh, no. No, if they ever have they had any problems or concerns about any questions about the care of the people that they were taking care of, they would always come to me and we would talk about it. Sometimes I would go into the room because they'd ask me to look at the patient to help them. So I would go into the room. Absolutely. I would always do that.
So I know that was new to you at the time. So there was no active review of charts. It was only if the APP, I know they weren't called that at the time, the advanced practice provider, came to you with questions or requested help at the time. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And I know that was new to you at the time. And the other violation, Ms. Castro, if I understand correctly, is not filling out the application correctly. There were two incidents of not properly notifying the board of the malpractice. Is that correct?
Yes, that is correct. The first application, she was notified that she didn't disclose. And then on the second application that was submitted, both questions were answered no again.
And doctor, you said you retained a licensing bureau, a company, to try to help you fill it out the second time, and it still was not correct?
No, but the third time.
Third
the
time.
Second time, I did not go in and change the computer. I'm not very computer person, and I didn't go change the no, but I mailed Irma, Ms. Dominic, all the papers the second time, but that didn't fly. So because I couldn't get it on, she said she needed it in PDF. So by November, that's when I hired the medical licensing company.
So my question to the board is, does this raise the level? I do not think this raises the level at all of denying a licensure, and I appreciate anybody who says they like to serve in underserved areas. But does this raise the level where we need to have a letter of concern for failure to adequately supervise a nursing practitioner, and for the ARS mentioned for misrepresentation for not providing the board notice of the malpractice in two different cases. That is something that's come up before and is concerning, whether intentional or not. What does the board think?
I'm going to say, I think Dr. Cunningham again, that I feel that she's given an adequate explanation. And I think she tried to correct it. The licensing firm to help her clearly these are, you know, over 27 years ago, you know, that we're dealing with. At that time, I think we have a physician that's trying to do her best. It wasn't a perfect application. The second time around, she admits she did not do it correctly. And that's when she said, I get somebody to help her. So I don't think it was done maliciously. I don't think it was done in an intent to deceive or anything like that. So in my opinion, no, I don't think she deserves to have a letter of concern.
Is that a motion, Dr. Cunningham?
I'm making a motion for an unrestricted license to practice in the state of Arizona.
Thank you. Do I have a second?
I'll second, Dr. Chapin.
Thank you. I have a motion and a second. Is there any further discussion? Are there any opposed? And all in favor, please indicate with an aye.
Aye.
Aye. That's unanimous. You swayed me, Dr. Cunningham. Thank you very much. And thank you, Dr. I'm going to try again. Logalbo?
Yes, I married him anyway. He's a Sicilian. Logalbo.
Logalbo. All right. Thank you very much, ma'am. I appreciate your time and effort, and welcome to Arizona. Thank you for your service of, three decades?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm very honored. Thank you so much.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you.
Mr. Bohol, would you like to move along?
Yes, let's move on to item number. item C, DO-260163A, Moira Chang, I believe the doctor signed in to speak. And represented by counsel, and I'll have Ms. Castro provide the summary.
Thank you. Go ahead, Ms. Castro.
Dr. Chang has submitted an application for a postgraduate training permit in April of 2026. During the review of her application, board staff notified her that she failed to disclose that she'd been placed on probation and had subsequently resigned during her previous family medicine residency training in Tacoma, Washington. Documentation received from Community Health Care Family Medicine Residency indicates that Dr. Chang was placed on probation January of 2024 and remained on probation until she resigned from the program in March of 2024. The probation was based on ongoing concerns due to deficits in fund of knowledge, lack of professionalism, lack of incorporating feedback of attendings, residents, and staff, and issues with using self-deprecating language in an unprofessional manner when communicating with CHC staff. In her written statement, Dr. Chang explained that following her resignation, she focused on a structured plan to prepare for re-entry into residency training. She reported engaging in application and interview preparation, reviewing and strengthening her core clinical knowledge, and participating in ongoing professional development to ensure her readiness to resume graduate medical training. Dr. Chang was accepted into a residency training at Abrazo Health Network Arrowhead, which was scheduled to start July 1st, 2026, with an anticipated end date of June 30th, 2027. Dr. Chang previously held a limited license in the state of Washington, and that license has since expired. The board's been provided a list of potential statute violations for review, and among them include ARS 32-1854-6, engaging in the practice of medicine in the manner that harms or may harm a patient or that the board determines falls below the community standard, 1854-9, procuring, renewing, or attempting to procure or renew a license to practice osteopathic medicine by fraud or misrepresentation, and 1854-19, committing any conduct or practice contrary to the recognized standards of ethics of the osteopathic medical profession.
Perfect. Thank you very much, Ms. Castro. Dr. Chang, or your attorney's name is Ms. Swalani? Is that correct?
Swalani. Good morning. I have a brief statement to make before Dr. Chang speaks. First of all, thank you to the board for the opportunity to speak today. I would like to emphasize that this deficiency stemmed from the fact that Dr. Chang was not made properly aware at the time of a probation at this former program. The program also did not enforce any of the probation conditions, thus causing confusion. Her intent was always to be truthful to the board. I believe she provided some exhibits to the board showing her recent communications with the program to clarify whether a probation occurred when she was in the process of completing her application, which is an example of her truthful character. Dr. Chang is willing to answer any questions the board may have following her statement.
Thank you, ma'am. Dr. Chang, please go ahead. Thank you for being here.
Yes, good morning to everybody. First and foremost, I really appreciate the opportunity to explain the discrepancy in my Arizona training license application, and it was never my intention to fail to disclose the probation. By way of background, as previously stated, I was a family medicine resident at Community Healthcare in Tacoma, Washington from July of 23 to March of 24. Their concerns were raised about my performance that were centered on professionalism and often described to me in subjective terms, such as my tone of voice, my eye contact, and communication style. At the time of the probation, I was uncertain as to what this period would be formally defined as, specifically whether it was a warning or a formal probation, given the unceremonious manner in which it was presented to me. For context, the document was placed on my desk for my signature without a formal meeting to explain the nature, significance, or expected duration of the process. The document was collected immediately after I signed it, and I was never provided an electronic copy for my records. Further, my program director never subsequently discussed the implications with me or explained how how the process would move forward. The probation was not addressed again after that. I was never given specific measurable objectives nor a structured improvement plan, and there was no further communication regarding what was expected of me or how my progress would be evaluated. After considerable reflection, I concluded that remaining in the program was not in my best academic nor professional interests. In March of 2024, I made the difficult decision to leave the program and focus on completing my remaining responsibilities professionally before pursuing a different path. Therefore, I left the program without a clear understanding of how that period would ultimately be characterized in my permanent training record. Looking back, I now recognize that the document itself, which I never received a copy of, was identified the designation ultimately reported by the program. When I completed the Arizona licensure application, I answered no to the question asking whether I'd been placed on probation, terminated, suspended, or had clinical privileges suspended. At the time, I was very confident that the other descriptions did not apply to me, and my uncertainty related specifically to details which had been informally presented to me over 2 years prior. As I mentioned, I did not have a copy of my resident file or any documentation from the program to reference. Because I was uncertain, I attempted to verify the information before submitting my application. In April, I emailed my former PD to request clarification because I wanted to make sure my application was accurate. In that email, I explicitly stated, "To ensure my application is consistent and accurate, I wanted to ask if you would be willing to share how you plan to complete Section 2. This portion of your submission has direct correlation to a section of my application, and this will allow me to maintain complete transparency as I embark on the new chapter of my training." When I did not receive a response, I completed the application based on my best recollection and understanding at the time. I was later informed that Community Healthcare was undergoing significant organizational changes, including the closure of the residency program, which provided additional context for the delays I experienced in obtaining a timely response and clarification regarding my training records. In June, I learned through PGT verification that the program reported I was on probation January 24th through March 8th of 24. It was at this point that I obtained a copy of the letter. If I had this prior, my application definitely would have reflected the probation. I've never attempted to conceal this difficult time of my training history. I'm very proud of the work I've done to rebuild my career after leaving my old program, and intentionally misrepresenting my training history would be inconsistent with the values I've tried to demonstrate throughout this process. I regret the mistake I made and accept full responsibility for my incorrect response. The limited documentation available to me, together with the lack of communication from my former program, despite my repeated attempts to obtain clarification, contributed to my misunderstanding. I am deeply grateful for the opportunity to return to residency training and remain committed to practicing medicine with honesty, integrity, professionalism, and full accountability. I sincerely appreciate the board's time, consideration, and willingness to review my explanation.
Thank you, Dr. Chang. Well said. Do you have copies of these emails to your program director requesting this information for clarification?
Yeah, they have been previously submitted, but I'm happy to share them with you as well.
I don't remember seeing that, Mr. Bohal. Is that in this information somewhere? Or Ms. Castro, sorry?
Yes, it is. It is under the probation during PGT PDF.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, thank you.
You'll see the emails.
Got it. Perfect. Thank you very much. Just my memory, not you. Thank you, Dr. Chang. I appreciate it. I'm getting older. Further questions for Dr. Chang? You're on mute, Dr. Cunningham.
There I go. Sorry about that.
Thank you.
Dr. Mayer, I'm not sure if this is something that we should go into executive session for to ask personal questions. I understand all the issues with her residency program. My concern is about this behavior that they listed for self-deprecating language and professional manner communicating with CHS.
Yes. Could we move to executive session for that? I'd like to make a motion to move to executive session for personal and confidential information and potential legal advice.
Second.
Thank you, Dr. Cunningham. Any opposed? All in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Good. You can move us over, Mr. Bahal. Thank you. Well, thank you, Dr. Chang. We appreciate your time. To the board, I don't see any reason to withhold the license. I wish this young doctor well. My question is, does this raise to the level of a letter of concern for 1854, 6, 9, 19, and 20, or do you think this is reasonable to proceed with a training permit with no letter of concern? Is anybody else concerned about anything else on the table besides those two options? Thank you. Do I have an opinion or a motion?
Dr. Maidema, I'll go first if that's okay.
Yes.
I feel comfortable with her explanation. I think clearly she's dedicated and she is, this is very important to her. I was impressed with her statement. And I feel that she should just have, there should be no letter of concern, that we just give her her training certificate. And I would make a motion for that.
Perfect. Do I have a second?
I'll second, Dr. Chapin.
We have a motion and a second. Is there further discussion? Are there any opposed? All in favor, please indicate with an aye. Aye.
Aye.
Aye, that is unanimous. You got everybody, Mr. Bohol?
That's it.
Okay, thank you very much for your time, Dr. Chang and Ms. Swalani. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you. Have a good rest of your day.
Good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for keeping at it. Where would you like to move to next? Are we at item 7, consent agreement, Mr. Bohol?
This is correct. And just as a note, I did not start the live stream again because we had invited the students. The students are present, so when we get to that section, you can go right into discussing with them.
Perfect.
Okay. Item 7 is the consent agenda for consideration. The action recommended for the case listed is issuing a letter of concern. If the board would like to discuss the case, we can place it on the next agenda, or we can accept a motion to accept the consent agenda as presented. We will close the case and issue the letter of concern.
And item A was failure to provide records in a timely fashion for the consent.
That's correct.
And the regulation is 10 days. Is that what I remember?
That's 10 days effective September 28th, I believe, this year. Prior to that, it was within 30 days.
Oh, okay. Got it. That's why it was stuck in my head wrong. Thank you very much. And, what was the time frame for the doctor to respond?
It was several months. I can find one more.
Several months is fine. Okay. If it was more than 30 days, it's outside of regulation either way.
But we did, and we have confirmed that the patient has since received the records.
Oh, good. No, I understand that that might have been something delayed if the doctor is no longer attached to that same company. But if the time frame was 7 months, that seems like something that should have been able to be accomplished. I do not have a problem with proceeding with the consent agreement. Are there any other questions or concerns from other board members or other information needed?
No.
Thank you. Do you need a vote on that, Mr. Bohol?
Yes, I do.
Okay. I'd like to make a motion to proceed with the consent agreement as listed.
Second.
Thank you. I have a motion and a second. Further discussion? Any opposed? I'm sorry, was that discussion? Any opposed? All in favor? Aye.
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 Okay. Thank you very much.
Moving on to the item 8, which is the discussion with the medical students. Medical students are present. Students, if you'd like to turn on your cameras, the board would like to discuss issues relating to the practice of osteopathic medicine. I just note that the board can't comment on any specifics of the cases today, but you're welcome to ask questions in the hypothetical sense, or if you'd like specific information, you're welcome to engage with the board in that way. And I'll turn it over to you, Dr. Maidema.
Thank you very much. Welcome, everybody. We really appreciate you spending your time. I give you a few minutes to be inside in the air conditioning instead of out there on this day. And I highly encourage you to ask any questions of us that you can. There's like 100 years of medical experience on this WebEx right now. Almost all of those are Dr. Cunningham.
Yes.
And Mr. Goodman is our public member here today. Unfortunately, one of our public members is ill right now. Mr. Bohol, could you do me a huge favor and describe the actual form of the board, the physician, non-physician members, and staff, just to give these students an idea of what the heck is happening here?
Sure. The board is formed with 7 board members. We have 5 physician members of varying specialties. All 7 board members are appointed by the governor. The 2 remaining spots are public members, so those are individuals that should have nothing to do with either an osteopathic school or a licensed healthcare provider. It's truly to be a voice for the public on the board. The board is empowered to regulate and future physicians like yourself, and handle both application and determining the credentials and requirements for licensure, as well as adjudicating complaints and remediation for physicians that stray outside the bounds of a normal practice. They employ a staff. We currently have a staff of 10, including myself as the executive director. We perform all the administrative functions and processes of the board, particularly in handling the processing of applications, to be able to present them in this forum for the board to make final decisions on cases that require it. I think that fairly well covers it. If there's anything else, I'm happy to share.
Oh, that was fantastic. Sorry, I always keep you on your feet. I should probably warn you when I'm going to ask you questions.
No, I like it. It's great.
So as you can tell, the board can only consist of so many specialties. We can't have every specialty represented. So we do use outside medical consultants, which we weigh into everything, because obviously we see complaints from every specialty. And even though it's not in our specialty, it's something that we have to be educated and learn enough to weigh in on. And our public members, like Mr. Goodman here, are extremely important because although we might have the medical training, sometimes we can get a little sidetracked or biased into our sciences. So he helps keep us on the straight and level. Is that fair, Mr. Goodman?
Somebody needs to be here to ask stupid questions sometimes.
Not at all. You asked some of the best questions, Mr. Goodman, and I really appreciate that because it is a responsibility we take very seriously on protecting the public, and you've probably heard us mention that a time or two. So I really encourage you to take a moment to please ask questions while you have our undivided attention. I'm an emergency room doctor and have a very short attention span, but you got us for a little bit here. What can we answer for you? Otherwise, we get to ask you questions. And you could just raise your hand. I think we could see all of you. No questions for this fine, educated, and wise group? Well, let me just, while you're thinking of questions, tell you a little bit about my primary concerns for myself and everybody else in this virtual room with us. We all do hard jobs. Mr. Goodman's a lawyer and deals with all kinds of things himself. In medicine, we deal with all kinds of problems, and even my administrative staff here are always burning candle at both ends here. I think the medical practice, becoming an osteopathic physician, is the best possible job that you can ever have, and I don't say that because it's my career. I started out in engineering, then sciences, and eventually came here because I think this is such an amazing career, and I love it. And at the same time, it always has me on the very edge of losing my mind because there's always something that goes wrong. There's always some system in place that doesn't work. There's always a patient who does not do exactly what you'd expect as far as their medical condition. Not necessarily their fault. Sometimes it is. But regardless, there are multiple stressors, usually all at the same time. So being able to keep your cool, keep your head in the game, and keep yourself mentally intact is super important. And a lot of us rely on family, which is absolutely perfect. That's what family's for. Using outside resources is Perfect. We like to think of ourselves as invulnerable. We take care of people we don't need to be taken care of, and that's just a lie. You will at some point push yourself over the edge, and it is so important to use help, to ask for help, or when you don't think you can practice safely, just give yourself a timeout. It's okay. We've all been there before. We'll all be there again, and don't keep going if you think it's affecting your practice, your ability to make objective and reasonable judgment. Because just one little moment when you're distracted can be the worst mistake of your life. And I'd rather you take a moment, take the 5 deep breaths, or take the day instead of making a terrible mistake. I don't want people to have to become reliant on substance use or other inappropriate behavior. It is a very common problem, much more common in the medical practice than in the general public. So just give yourself a moment. Realize you're a human being. Realize that you have the opportunity to do something amazing that by itself is fantastic. And sometimes that can help you survive the day. Sorry to lecture. It's just important to me. go ahead. Yeah, please, Dr. Cunningham.
Well said. All right. The only thing, anybody have any questions yet? We've been talking a lot here.
We have a hand to this, Dr. Cunningham. Oh. Yes, Dr. Hughes, please go ahead.
Oh, hi. Well, thank you. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
Well, it's been very interesting seeing these cases and kind of seeing the discussion around it. I was just kind of curious the kind of the outcomes. I guess I heard like degree of censure, or is it degree of censure as an outcome? Mm-hmm. I'm just kind of curious the different like levels of outcomes that you decide on, and then what those go on to like affect the doctor and kind of how their career progresses after that decision.
That's a great question. And Mr. Bohol, would you like to outline that?
Sure. So the board has various options, including non-disciplinary and disciplinary, as well as dismissal. So dismissal is entirely, there's no substances or the case has been remediated, and so that case is dismissed. They also have non-disciplinary options, which include a letter of concern, which is just notifying the physician, like, hey, we see some concerning patterns that, if continued, will cause a problem for you in the future. So we're letting you know that you need to address these, and here's the potential statutes that you could be affecting. The next step above that would be a non-disciplinary order for continuing medical education. So this is if the board sees a specific area that the physician is deficient in, but it doesn't rise to the level of discipline, but it does require some sort of educational training, they can specify a course that the physician shall complete within a specific time frame. That physician can actually use that credit towards the renewal of their license. So it's not an addition where the board's just specifying what they need to do for their continuing education. The next side of that is disciplinary actions. So the lowest level is administrative warning, which is a violation of the statute has occurred. Maybe there's no patient harm, or there's other mitigating factors that don't level or require either a decree of censure or probation or monitoring up to revocation or suspension. So admin warning kind of addresses low-level disciplinary items. Decree of censure is a permanent action. There's no probation attached to it. It's just that formal disciplinary reprimand that the physician has worked outside of the standard practice or deviated from the standard of care. Next level is requiring probation, which the board can set specific terms that they would like to see, either practice monitor, practice restriction, disciplinary continuing education, chart reviews, anything of that nature they can specify as a probationary term. And they also specify how long that probation will last and when the physician can request termination of the probation. If it becomes more severe, the board can either suspend or revoke the license. They can suspend the license for any length of time you know, depending on the severity of it, but that would allow the physician to return back to practice. But revocation is a full revocation of the license. If the license is revoked, the physician must immediately stop practicing. They are able to apply again after 5 years, but that is, again, reported to National Practitioner Data Bank. The board has the ability and the discretion to deny the license in the future based on the fact that they have a revoked license. So all of that's available for consideration. So that's the gamut of the board's discretion and ability to adjudicate cases.
Thank you, Mr. Boholm. And I'd like to pretend I have that all memorized, but I have a chart as a screensaver there. That's perfect. Student Dr. Herrera, looks like you have a question.
No, I didn't have a question. Thank you, Dr. Bannerman. I just want to say thank you for letting us join in on all of this. It's been very enlightening, but I didn't have a specific question, though.
I know. I'm picking on you, Ricky. It's
good. Okay.
Any other questions from the medical students? Thank you. Anything else from the board? Dr. Cunningham, did you have further?
I just wanted to, you know, you had mentioned it just briefly earlier, and I always like to just bring it up again. We didn't have specifically any cases we talked about today, but remember that, as Dr. Maiden said, this is a stressful time. And if, when you get into practice, it's even more stressful. And so many times, sometimes people go to substances or alcohol use, things like that. And so if you have an issue now, or you have a colleague or your friend that has an issue now, please take care of that now. Because if it comes before the board, it's not a good thing. And so a lot of restrictions that can happen. It can restrict your practicing and all those things. And so there's all those questions that need to be, if you have that, please take care of that. It may cost a friendship if you, you know, have a friend, but please help your friend or your colleague with that. Fortunately, the board has a program that if you do have an issue and you come forward voluntarily and you're practicing and you admit that you have some substance issue, that there's a confidentiality program. So there is that for you to go forward. But if there's something that happens that is, you know, before you come forward, such as a DUI or something like that, that could also affect that in the future. So I always tell all my med students, what is the first thing you do? We all like to have fun. We like to go out and celebrate after we pass our boards, major tests. And if you have one drink, what do we do? Please call Uber or Uber. Don't take that chance. I'm going to tell you, if you have a DUI, that will follow you for the rest of your career. Just like you kind of saw earlier with some cases, you're going to have to record that for the rest of your life, for applications, hospital, insurances, all of those things. So that would be my advice moving forward. And thank you. You're the future of osteopathic medicine. We're so excited to be here.
I like the way you said, don't worry, it'll get worse there, Dr. Cunningham. Perfect. That's the emergency room motto. Mr. Goodman.
I'll piggyback off of both of those. So I have personal experience with substance abuse. I'm a recovering addict. It's been a really long time, but for a long time in my life, it was also very destructive. And to Dr. Cunningham's point, I was very angry at some people who outed me or made my life what I thought was more difficult at the time. Turns out saved my life, made my life much better. I have a wonderful life now, much better than I could ever imagine. But because I did the work, because people close to me did the uncomfortable thing to try to help me, right? They didn't just stand by and hope that somebody else was going to address it. So to Dr. Cunningham's point, yes, do that. You know, ruin the friendship if it means you're saving someone from hurting themselves or hurting other people. And eventually that person will come around. We all know somebody who's suffering, or we've suffered ourselves, or you're going to know somebody. So just want to propound that point that get help soon. The earlier, the better. And then another thing that comes up frequently on these in our meetings is not disclosing information, not thinking that you had to disclose something that should have been disclosed, and then we get to meet you. And it's so much easier from the outset to just be completely transparent. Disclose everything. It is much better in every case to disclose something and it not needed to be there than to not disclose something that we should have known about and then getting to meet us back here. I did the same thing with law school. I had to fill out all the separate addenda where, you know, I had to describe all the trouble I got in and things that happened. And when I went through character and fitness, it was, you know, it was a breeze because I'd been transparent since my initial testing when I applied for that to getting, you know, getting my license. So just, you know, if there's ever a doubt, just disclose it is my opinion. I think it'll make your process easier. But thank you all for being here. Thank you for putting in all the hard work. We need more doctors, so thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Goodman. Dr. Chapon is our vice president. Would you like to speak to the students?
Okay, I think you guys took most of my thoughts, but no. Thank you all. That's good. It's all good. thank you all for being here. I think, yeah, I absolutely. And if you, regarding the Arizona board, at least I know Mr. Bohal is happy to answer any questions. If you ever have a question regarding what you should disclose, again, it's always best to give them a call and find out. As far as your education, stay current. Make sure that you're, you know, I mean, you're taught to read studies objectively. Make sure that you're doing what, you know, doing procedures and policies and staying current within your specialty and practicing within your specialty. You know, and what you're trained to do. So I think those are all important things that are reasons why people end up at the board. So if you want to avoid coming here besides as a student, that would be advisable. So yeah, and I think thank you again for being here. I appreciate your time, and hopefully today, hope you learned something and you'll take with you. So
thank you, Dr. Chapon. And just one last thing, just remember every time that you put on that jacket, put on that badge, or represent yourself as a physician, you're representing yourself and your profession. So just make sure you keep that professional and appropriate demeanor. Think twice about what you say, what you post, what you do, because what the patients think of you, what the public thinks of you, makes a difference on your effectiveness as a physician, the trust that you garner, and the ability for your medical recommendations to carry weight. So thank you for what you're doing. I appreciate you being here. Proud of you, Ricky. And you guys take care, log off, do something else for the rest of your day. We're just going to do some boring business. So take care, everybody. Go ahead, Mr. Bohal. You can carry on. Keep us on time.
Wonderful. Okay, I will move to item 10A, which is the report from the executive director. Just to update you, the legislature did convene, pass a budget for FY 2027. We did receive a adequate appropriation to be able to continue operations this year. I will have some further news to share and report at the next meeting because I do not have a actual monthly document from our accounting team yet. So I'll have additional information to share. The licensure and investigations update, I did want to share that we have completed this year's postgraduate training permit season. I did want to highlight that we had another record-breaking year. We received a 30% increase in the number of applications and renewals for PGT students.
Well done.
775 renewals and applications.
Wow.
So osteopathic physicians are doing very, very well in postgraduate training programs.
Great.
We are continuing to work through cases, especially older ones, and get them closed. We are working to reduce our time frames. We did hire a couple of contract workers last year to be able to move some of those cases forward. We did see some success in that. So I hope to have further good news to report in the future. And my last item, since the last board meeting, there were 4 executively dismissed complaints. And with that, it concludes my report.
Perfect. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. Anything else from anybody else, or do you guys want to get out there and enjoy a hot day? Okay, I'll make a motion to adjourn.
I'll second.
I don't see any opposed. Really, staff, I.